Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today on the show, a couple of stories that prove that sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. The all-girl group The Runaways had, you know, runaway success in the late 1970s, but after the band collapsed, everyone had a different story to tell about who was responsible for their various successes and ultimate failure. Many people have tackled the band's history in print and on film. I'll talk to the author of the latest book on Joan Jett's old group, who claims to have written the real chronicle of the Runaways. And Christine Young. 10 years ago, she was an aspiring singer from St. Louis. Now she hangs with some of rock's most idiosyncratic superstars. Everyone from David Bowie to Dave Grohl to Morrissey. Morrissey's a fan, but more than fans, they've also become collaborators. Christine Young's explosive new album is called The Knife Shift, and she'll play some of it live in our studio. But first, one of the most unlikely tales of all.
Viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas, with your neon flashing and your one-armed bandits crashing all those hawks down the drain.
He called himself Doc Pomus, and he wrote some of the most popular songs of the 1950s and 60s. Songs like Viva Las Vegas, Save the Last Dance for Me, and This Magic Moment. But a new documentary called AKA Doc Pomus aims to share the story of the man behind the hits, a disabled Brooklyn songwriter who succeeded in the music industry against all odds. I'm joined here in the studio today by one of the film's directors, Peter Miller. Peter, welcome.
Nice to be here.
And the film's producer, Sharon Felder, who is also Doc Pomus's daughter. Sharon, welcome to you.
Thanks, John.
Your father was the ultimate outsider, in a sense. Born a Jewish kid in Brooklyn, paralyzed by polio as a kid, the story of how he managed to enter the music industry, it almost reads like fiction, doesn't it?
It was stranger than fiction, actually. I don't think you could have invented his life. He was about a 17-year-old kid that wanted to be a blues singer. I mean, a Jewish crippled kid in Brooklyn listening to the radio, and got himself to a club in Lower Manhattan and convinced people that he was a blues singer and got up on a stage and he could wail.
Yeah. Peter, how hard was it to find, you know, photos, clips, recordings, you know, all the sort of archival material? Because we're going back, like, to the, what, late 40s, early 50s at this point?
Well, we were blessed to have a wonderful relationship with Sharon and her family, who have collected massive amounts of stuff about Doc's life. But it's always hard to find archival materials going back that far. And Doc is not a household name.
Right.
It's not like there's, you know, massive amounts of images out there of him. Most people, when you say Doc Pomus, they vaguely have heard of this. Maybe they saw it on a record label. But Doc Pomus is behind the scenes. He's a songwriter.
Mm-hmm. And the name Doc Pomus, Sharon, why does he come up with a stage name?
Well, you know, he's born Jerome Solon Felder. At some point, there's so many different stories as to how he became Doc Pomus, but he sort of invented it. He thought it sounded like a hip midnight character. That's what he always told me.
Mm-hmm.
And he just really liked the sound of it. He played around with a lot of names. Some people, one of the stories he said was that Doc was named after Dr. Clayton, a blues singer that he liked.
Right.
But I think he just really liked that it sounded kind of a hip name.
Yeah. But, Peter, there was another reason why he needed a stage name, right?
Well, he was sneaking out and going to these nightclubs, and he was singing the blues, and I don't think his mom liked that idea, and he wanted to hide it from her.
Right. So he didn't want his name splashed up outside the clubs where his mom might see it.
After a while, that became something that he couldn't avoid because he did pretty well.
But in the 1940s and early 50s, Doc Pomus is out there, and he's actually making it. I mean, he's making these records. They're not million sellers or anything, but he's recording as a blues singer.
Well, roll a boogie, roll it good and strong. Well, roll a boogie. till the break of day. We'll jump till the break of day. And we'll drive our blues away. So let's get groovy, make your chick boogie too. So let's get groovy, make your chick boogie too. Then she'll feel it when we're through.
That is Doc Pomus and Doc's Boogie. The young Doc Pomus trying to make it as a kind of, as a blues singer in the clubs here in New York. Got a couple of sides recorded. Peter, you tell a story somewhat early in the movie, a.k.a. Doc Pomus, about, is it RCA that actually buys one of his recordings and then when they realize what they've got, decides not to release it?
Yeah, he had a wonderful song called Heartlessly, and it could be a hit. I mean, people love this song, and Alan Freed is pushing this song.
The famous DJ.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this could have been an early rock and roll hit, but I don't think the people at the record company thought that there was a lot of possibility for a disabled Jewish kid in his early 30s. This was not the kind of rock star that they had in mind.
So maybe... it was not meant to be that he would be a singer. Did he regret that? I mean, he goes on to become this amazingly famous and successful songwriter. Did he ever express to you, Sharon, any regrets that he didn't get to pursue that part of his career?
I think he had a deep passion for singing, and I think on some level he must have regretted it, but he really closed that door. And once he did that, he put all his energies into writing.
Right. Now, how did that transition happen?
Well, rock and roll is beginning to happen, and there's a need for people to write songs for these up-and-coming artists. I mean, Doc had a relationship with the people at Atlantic Records, the fantastic R&B label, and he's writing songs for people like Ray Charles and Big Joe Turner and others. But there's this new form of music that's happening. There's people who are coming up who need songs, and Doc's got this real aptitude for writing these songs in this new genre, and he starts writing for young rock and roll musicians. He teams up with a younger person who he meets named Mort Schumann, and they create some of the early hits of rock and roll.
So Doc at this point is probably, what, in his mid-30s?
Mid-30s, but if I could just backtrack for 1 second, in that he was always writing songs from the time he was singing.
So that Doc's Boogie that we heard.
Yeah,
for
he wrote all this stuff that he sang, and all of and his musicians originally were like Mickey Baker, King Curtis. He had the most smoking band, and so he was signed to Atlantic, and he wrote for Ruth Brown, Ray Charles. He wrote Lonely Avenue, all those great songs way before he met Mort Schumann, mm-hmm. and then was signed.
So 1956, he writes Lonely Avenue for Ray Charles. Was this his first like real hit?
Absolutely, and I think that's his favorite.
My room has got two windows, but the sunshine never comes through. You know it's always dark and dreary since I broke off, baby.
'56 hit for Ray Charles called Lonely Avenue. It was written by Doc Pomus, the subject of the film called A.K.A. Doc Pomus. We're speaking with Peter Miller, co-director of the film, and Sharon Felder, Doc Pomus's daughter and producer of the movie. Lonely Avenue, just that title, Peter. You know, you talk a little bit about this in the film that, he's walking around. At this point, he wasn't yet completely confined to a wheelchair, but still, the braces and, you know, the polio, the disability. He feels what he's writing in these songs.
Well, Doc would probably have said that he was writing songs just to write songs because he was an artist, a craftsman. He was a songwriter. But it's hard to escape the fact that so many of his songs are in many ways autobiographical. And one of the things that we were able to do in this movie was to connect those songs to his life story. Our wonderful film editor, Amy Linton, would weave these songs into his story. And Doc might have said, no, I was just writing songs. Hmm. But Lonely Avenue, man, that speaks to what he must have been going through and the kind of life he was living.
Now, Sharon, you're familiar with the Lonely Avenue record that Ben Folds did with the English writer Nick Hornby?
Oh, yeah. I was blown away when I discovered that one day. I went to their book signing, and we had a great time together. Yeah.
There's a song on the record called Doc Pomus.
It's crazy. I know. That just blew me away. Yeah. And they talk in the song, if I recall, the lyrics go something like, man in a wheelchair and sitting in the lobby of the Forest Hotel where my dad held court. And it was pretty, that just was so funny.
Yeah.
Moving.
Soundcheck listeners, you can find a session with Nick Hornby and Ben Folds from the Lonely Avenue, when the Lonely Avenue album came out, on our website at soundcheck.org. The whole idea, though, of Doc Pomus as this lonely guy stuck in his wheelchair, he never lacked for female companionship, is the impression that you get as the film goes on.
It's, my whole life, you know, my father always had, my mother's very beautiful. The significant woman in his life was very beautiful, Shirley Hauser, for many, many years, and always had beautiful girlfriends prior and after both of those women. And I think it was the blues that he was emoting. And so Lonely Avenue is a blues, and he always felt that. But he was also a very joyous and hilariously funny person.
So when you say he was holding court there in the hotel lobby, I mean, people were just
drawn.
He seems
to
have had some kind of magnetism.
Oh, he drew everybody in. You know, the prostitutes, the comedians, whoever was hanging out. The Forest was an amazing hotel. And everybody from Johnny Carson would bring a hooker there to, you know, Rodney Dangerfield kept a room there, and then Phil Spector. So it was really, you know, a place that everybody hung out in the lobby.
Was it a place for a kid?
Oh, yeah. I spent a lot of time there as a kid, and I loved it. And I would be babysat by the elevator operator from the Hotel Ozzy. And as a matter of fact, Peter Guralnick wants me to do a book of my adventures at the Forest.
Peter Guralnick is one of the interviewees that we hear from a lot.
Peter Guralnick, the amazing music writer. And I have to say that one of the things about Doc's magnetism is he drew people into his life who are some of the most articulate, soulful, brilliant people I've ever had the pleasure of interviewing. I think Doc created a kind of solar system around himself, which was just extraordinary, full of some of the most amazing people.
Mm-hmm. And so we get to hear from Joan Osborne and Lou Reed and Benny King, with whom Doc Pomus has an early and very, very productive relationship. Tell us about, Sharon, tell us about this magic moment.
Well, my dad was signed, you know, with Mort Schumann. They wrote so many amazing songs for the Drifters. This Magic Moment, Save the Last Dance for Me, I Count the Tears, Sweets for My Sweets. And Benny King was just the perfect voice. Well, see, actually, Benny was with a group called the Crowns. And my dad found them, signed them, and then that became the Drifters.
Hmm.
And the vocal of Ben is just about as beautiful as it gets.
Great song from 1960 by Doc Pomus, sung by the Drifters featuring Benny King.
This magic moment, so different and so new, was like any other until I kiss you, and then it happened. It took me by surprise. I knew that you felt it too. By the look in your eyes, sweeter than wine, softer than the summer night. Everything I want I have, whenever I hold you tight. This magic moment, while your lips are close to mine, will last forever.
The Drifters and This Magic Moment, a song from the magic pen of Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann. Can we assign lyrics to one, music to the other, or is that not how they worked?
Originally, my dad did both. Then, when he started to work with Mort Schumann, Mort had never written before. He was a young kid who was my dad's cousin's young friend, an 18-year-old. And he sort of trained him. He had him in a room, and slowly, through osmosis, I suppose, he absorbed how to do it more and more. And so then they eventually assigned 50-50, but it kind of overlapped always. And so my dad would throw a melody line, Mort would throw a lyric. But essentially, he was a lyricist towards his later years, and Mort did the music.
We're speaking with Sharon Felder, the producer of the film, a.k.a. Doc Pomus, and daughter of the late songwriter. Peter Miller is co-director of the film, a.k.a. Doc Pomus. So he's got this incredible run of songs. He's got this great songwriting partner in Mort Schumann. He's got this beautiful wife in Willie Burke, Sharon, your mom. And then it all falls apart. The marriage dissolves. Mort moves to, is it France, to become a singer? And then what happens to the song? There's like a sea change in the music world, right, Peter?
Well, at some point in the mid-60s, Bob Dylan is writing songs. The Beatles are writing songs. And the need for a songwriter, for the Brill Building, this building full of wonderful, brilliant songwriters crafting songs for singers, kind of fades away a little bit. People expect that the singers should be writing their own song. And what role is there for Doc Pomus, extraordinary songwriter? He can't really make a living anymore. And so for about 10 years in his life, he turns to card playing, to gambling, and he's very good at it. And he actually makes a living and supports his family through poker.
And there's a really neat little clip of Doc Pomus. This is archival footage that you got for the film, talking about that moment in his life.
Well, I always felt that writing songs was like gambling to me. You know, it's a different kind of gambling. Deep inside my soul, I felt that I wasn't destined to be a winner, you know? And if I overcame the odds, I would have a shot at the card game. So it was kind of an extension of my life, you know, playing cards.
And there's like card sharks talking about how they heard about the game. You know, if there was a good game, you would hear about it. And Doc Pomus was running a good game. And
John, it was hardcore.
Now, Sharon, how much did you see of your father around this time?
Oh, I lived with my father during this time. So it was basically myself and Shirley living in a two-room apartment. And I was in high school. So I would buy the food for the card game. I would get the cash from the loan shark down the street. We'd stock up on cold cuts, like bags of cigarettes, and then he'd have somebody at the door with a gun that, you know, had to protect the game. And then there'd be like a girl with a cocktail waitress apron that would serve the players. And it was super Sopranos hardcore situation.
So he was he the house?
Yeah, so it was in the apartment.
He was making money no matter what
exactly
was happening.
We had to, he needed to have some sort of steady income.
Right. And how was his health at this point?
He was just, he smoked and he was overweight. But otherwise, he was highly functioning in every other way.
Right.
In a wheelchair, you know, from polio.
Now, so at some point, he comes out of this decline. He's got the second girlfriend, and he starts this songwriting workshop. And lo and behold, all these people show up, you know, Sean Colvin, Joan Osborne.
Dozens of people
would come
to his workshops and learn the art of songwriting. And here's a guy who's one of the greatest songwriters in the world, and he's giving songwriting lessons to young songwriters. And so, you know, it was amazing to talk to Joan Osborne, who's had a, you know, stellar career, who learned songwriting at a Doc Pomus songwriting workshop. And he brought in the greatest peers to teach these workshops, Lou Reed, Tom Waits. I mean,
Otis Blackwell.
I mean, these are the greatest songwriters around, teaching young, sharing their knowledge. And this is part of who Doc was. He was a person who was a generous, big-hearted soul.
Mm-hmm. His legacy exists in all of these songs that we know and many that we don't. I was unfamiliar with the Willie DeVille. I mean, I was a big Mink DeVille fan in the early days. And to find that Doc Pomus had worked with Willie was like, oh, Will, I didn't know that.
I even babysat for Will. I used to babysit for his kids.
It's a long, illustrious career and a remarkable life behind it, documented in the film called AKA Doc Pomus. We've been speaking with the co-director, Peter Miller, and Sharon Felder, the producer of the film and daughter of Doc Pomus. Thank you both for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, the singer and songwriter Christine Young joins me in the studio to play songs from her razor-sharp new record. It's called The Knife Shift. And later I'll talk to the author of a biography about the groundbreaking rock group The Runaways. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Singer and keyboardist Christine Young writes dramatic, intense songs that really catch the ear. And that has put her in pretty good company. David Bowie has co-written a song with her. Bowie's longtime producer, Tony Visconti, now produces her records. Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters is all over the new album. And the singer Morrissey recently tapped her, again, as the opening act on his American tour. Christine Young and her band joined me here in the Soundcheck studio to play some of her new songs. This first one is called This Is War.
Mind.
That is Christine Young and her band live on Soundcheck and the song This Is War. It's the lead-off track on The Knife Shift. Christine Young playing the keyboards and singing, Megan X. Thomas on bass, and Baby Jeff White behind our drum kit. A lot of noise for just three people. Christine, good to see you again.
Yes, noise. Thank you.
So you told us when you were still in the process of making this record that you were trying to sort of capture the sound of the music you liked when you were growing up in St. Louis.
Yeah.
What was that music?
Well, I mean, I've always liked a wide range of music. I like the freedom that music, I feel that music used to have a little more of or whatever. I felt more freedom back then. And I mean, specifically, probably this film, it was even old when I was when I was young. But like we used to, it was like this tape. We used to pass it around from kid to kid.
What film is that?
Erg, A Music War. And it had like just a wide variety of artists. And they were all very colorful and very different. And I feel like in some way like I'm influenced by every single one of those bands on that.
You know, I've never seen Erg, although I've heard of it. I mean, you know, it's just one of those things. I mean, it's got like The Police and XTC and
Klaus Nomi, yes.
Devo, Gary mm-hmm. Newman, all this Gang of Four.
Yes.
So that was like
Dead Kennedys, like yes.
I mean, it's just like an astonishing kind of lineup of great music of the early 80s, I guess. And is it, like, out there? Can people still watch? I mean,
yeah,
you talk
about... Yeah, I just ordered it.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah, it's on DVD now. It took years, I guess. I don't know why.
Well,
I expect...
anything with all that music is going to be a rights nightmare.
Yes.
Yeah. So is there anything else? Or is it just, like, a series of music performances? Is there some kind of narrative thread that ties it all together?
No. I think it's performances in about four different cities, like London, L.A., New York, and maybe, I can't remember, but someplace else. And that's what's so wonderful about it. And, the audiences are so great, too. I love looking at the audiences of that time, too.
So this was something that you and your friends would kind of, like, pass around.
Yes.
Did you have, growing up in St. Louis, was there much of a music scene other than that? I mean, was there a radio station that was playing anything cool or anything notable?
I mean, not really. I mean, it has its community station, as places do. Mm-hmm.
So the left end of the dial,
yes.
where the community and the NPR station. Now, the song you just played, This Is War, mentions NPR at one point.
It does mention
NPR. You know,
NPR.
You're the talk of NPR, yeah. and your sound is climbing the charts. Who is that song aimed at?
Well, I don't know. I was thinking about people that we go to war with often. If you look at it from afar, it's hard to tell that you hate these people because it looks like your culture almost becomes consumed with these people, and we know everything about them,
and
a lot of times there's the sound of their music, you know, gets into the pop music, and we talk about them all the time, and we know everything, and then our soldiers will have babies with them, so they'll become us, you know.
Mm.
So it almost looks like love sometimes, you know, or
Now, am I remembering correctly that you're part Apache?
Yes, my mother.
So that, you know, that sense of the other with a capital O becoming part of us, you've got that in your DNA.
Yes.
Has that, I mean, do you work with that? Has that affected the way you make music in any way?
I don't really know because I didn't grow up with my birth parents. I can only surmise, you know, some of that, like what...
Well, so a lot of this album, you know, there's this song you're going to do for us next called Jealous of Loved Children. Is that part of the experience of growing up, you know, in foster care and
yes.
stuff?
Yes. It's growing up, but it's also now, you know, like I talk about how we really always are children, you know, in a way, and just feeling like you're not the loved one, you know, in some way. And looking at the ones that are. But yeah, definitely it was about the foster home I grew up in.
Okay. The album called The Knife Shift from my guest Christine Young. Dave Grohl plays drums and guitar on this record. How did that happen?
Yes. Well, he guest hosted on Chelsea Lately, this TV show,
TV
Chelsea
show.
Lately.
Yeah.
And there is a writer on Chelsea lately that comes to a lot of my shows, and I guess they hit it off, and she made a mixtape for him. They hit it off, like, musically. They talked a lot about music. And one of my songs was on this mixtape, and I guess he liked it, and he looked me up on YouTube, and then we started emailing, and at that very time, I was making this record, and my drummer had just fallen away. Not Jeff, it was somebody else at the time.
Uh-huh.
But I said, oh, so would you like to play drums on this record? And, you know, luckily he said yes.
And he said yes, but only if I can play guitar too? Or?
No, no, no. That came later. It felt, we just clicked. I know it sounds ridiculous, but like we just like clicked almost immediately. He knows all these references and everything. And like we have very similar taste in a lot of that. And so after the drumming session, it was like, you want to play some guitar? Yes. So that's how it happened.
All right. So Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters, and before that from Nirvana, is on Christine Young's The Knife Shift. But she's here today with Megan Thomas on bass and baby Jeff White behind the drums. You want to play this song?
Yes.
It's called Jealous of Loved Children. It's new from Christine Young. She and the band playing for us live now here in the Soundcheck studio. Christine Young and her band live on Soundcheck. Jealous of Loved Children is the name of that song. Christine, great to see you again. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun talking to you.
next, a recent book about the Runaways claims to be the first to tell the full story about this influential late 70s girl group. We'll speak with the author next on Soundcheck. Oh, yeah. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The Runaways were an all-girl rock group formed in L.A. in 1975. They turned heads in New York at CBGB's, became stars in Japan, and then crashed and burned after four short years. The group, which included Lita Ford, Joan Jett, and Sherry Curry, has seen its story told before, on screen and in print. Recently, the music writer Evelyn McDonald released her own take on their tale. The book is called Queens of Noise, The Real Story of the Runaways. She joins us by phone from her home in L.A. Evelyn McDonald, welcome back to Soundcheck.
I'm so happy to be back.
With The Real Story of the Runaways. So this is, as I mentioned, a story that we've seen in film and it's been told numerous times before. What made you think that we were not getting the real story?
Well, the film was a biopic. It was clearly not a documentary. I'm referring to the film The Runaways, the Florida Sigis Monday 2010 movie starring Kristen Stewart and Dakota Fanning, a movie I enjoyed very much. However, it was essentially a version of the book Neon Angel, which was Cherie Curry's memoir of her time in The Runaways, which is also a good book, but limited in scope. Cherie Curry was not actually in The Runaways for the entire band's duration, and The Runaways was a diverse group of individuals who had varying points of view on their saga and some disagreements about what was fact and fiction in Cherie's book. So there was also another documentary in this case, another movie, Edge Play, that told the points of view of many of the band members, but left out a seminal player, Joan Jett.
Yeah. So you got something that all these previous efforts didn't get, which was nearly unanimous participation.
Right. And also, I was an outsider. I'm an objective journalist, historian, looking, you know, at them from a distance. I wasn't in the band. Mm-hmm. So I could look objectively and try to incorporate everybody's point of view.
And how hard...
Even if they didn't participate.
Uh-huh. And how hard was it to get, you know, Joan Jett and Cherie Curry and all the rest of them to talk to you?
Well, it wasn't easy, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
It was harder for some than for others.
You had a chance to maybe dispel some of the, if not mythology, at least some of the one-sidedness of the film and of some of the other things that you've mentioned.
Right, and I think I did some dispelling of mythologies also.
Let's give people a chance to hear who we're talking about. The Runaways sort of appear on the scene in the mid-1970s, and, you know, they look like a bunch of teenage runaways, and they certainly play up that with this early hit called Cherry Bomb. Stay at home, can't stay in school. Cherry Bomb from The Runaways, from their debut album released in 1976. Joan Jett and Kim Fowley, their manager, wrote the song, lead vocals by Cherie Curry. Evelyn McDonald's book is called Queens of Noise, The Real Story of the Runaways. I would imagine, Evelyn, that if you were the father of a teenage girl in 1976 and heard that song, that's like your worst nightmare.
Yeah. I probably. Obviously, they are playing with their jailbait imagery very specifically, and the multiple meanings of Cherry, and of course, playing off Cherie Curry's name.
Mm-hmm. Were they actually runaways?
No. None of them were actually runaways, except for the woman, Carrie Crome, who wrote some of their lyrics, and it was partly her idea for the band to form, for there to be an all-girl band to sing her songs. And she did eventually run away from home. They did tend to come from broken homes in California, the, you know, 1970s, high divorce rate. And they definitely were girls who wanted to explore the world and get out of their suburban environments. And they certainly achieved that.
Right.
They traveled the world. They went to Japan. They toured Europe a few times. They toured North America.
And they did so as, you know, I mean, they were minors, you know, when they got together, right? They were 16,
absolutely.
15 even.
Yes, they were very young. They had to get their parents to sign the contracts that they signed with Kim Fowley. And they did move away from home, some of them, while they were still underage. They did go, Joan Jett and Lita Ford, the guitar player, actually went and lived with Kim Fowley for a while and then got their own apartment. So they were certainly independent young women. And, you know, this was a time when rock and roll was getting a little little fat around the paunch, you know, the Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones weren't the spring chickens they wanted to be. So these young girls all of a sudden appear on the rock scene. And of course, there were young girls on the rock scene, but these girls were playing guitars and writing songs. And they were really a breath of fresh air. I mean, they were really embraced in Los Angeles.
Two things there I want to follow up on, Evelyn. One is Kim Fowley, their manager. Big topic. Let's get to him in a moment. But as you just said, they're writing their own songs. This was not some prefab group that was put together and then, you know, fed songs by some male Svengali. They were out there not just playing songs, but writing them.
Right. This is true. I mean, there was a Svengali-like figure involved, which was Kim Fowley, and we will get to him in 1 minute. But Kim wanted them to not just be the Monkees. He wanted them to write their songs. He was a 30-year-old man, 33-year-old man, 35-year-old man who didn't want to, who was trying to figure out what it was like to be a teenage girl. And he really valued their opinions and their input, and he encouraged them to write songs. And I think Joan Jett wrote some of the best songs she ever wrote while she was in The Runaways.
And you mentioned Carrie Crome, who actually co-wrote this next song with Joan Jett and Kim Fowley and Sandy West. This is from the album Queens of Noise from The Runaways.
California!
California Paradise by The Runaways from their 1977 record, Queens of Noise. The Runaways are the subject of Evelyn McDonald's book, Queens of Noise, the real story of The Runaways. All right, so let's talk about Kim Fowley, their manager. I mean, Evelyn, it seems like it would be easy to find something unsavory in this 35-year-old guy who's shepherding all these underage young women around, but you paint a much more complex portrait of this, or maybe he paints it himself, since he seems to have kept you on the phone for literally hours on end.
Yes, and certainly there were unsavory things going on. Kim was by no means a saint. he was probably not equipped to handle five teenage girls and did things he shouldn't have done. Abused them verbally, certainly, sexually harassed some of them. Sheree Curry spoke very poorly of Kim for a long time, but has actually come around and forgiven him, and he participated in the movie, The Runaways.
Mm-hmm. What about the way the band was perceived, back in the 70s, when they were still on the scene and Kim Fowley was, sort of pulling the strings behind the scene? How did press and radio perceive The Runaways?
Radio in the United States in particular did not like The Runaways. Got very little play in the United States. They got quite a lot of press coverage, including covers of Crawdaddy and of some of the English papers, and certainly in Japan they got a lot of press coverage. And then in Japan they had top 10 hits,
mm-hmm.
And albums, and media, numerous television appearances. But there was this tendency to write them off as a novelty act, to assume that they were just the female monkeys.
What about the music? I mean, was the music, you'll pardon the pun, playing second fiddle to the look of the Runaways?
It was hard for people to take the music seriously. It's hard for critics, I should say, to take the music seriously. Fans loved the music and their shows. They were a very popular live band. They always converted critics during their shows. I quote many reviews where even critics who had shrugged them off before say, well, you know what, I saw them, and actually they really do play their instruments, as it turns out, and they can play, and they put on quite a good show.
You also quote Lisa Robinson in Cream magazine saying that they do near-perfect imitations of rock stars doing imitations. So they didn't convert everybody.
Which was a really good line, I have to say.
Yeah, it is.
Pretty good cut down.
What was going on in Japan that made the Runaways so huge there?
Well, I think the Japanese love people who put on a show and who are like cartoonist superheroes. So they, they loved Suzy Quatro. They loved Kiss and the Beatles, and they would go on to love Cheap Trick. And also, I think that in Japan, they had a particularly female audience who I think looked up to these women as superheroes expressing themselves in ways that maybe they didn't get to express themselves in the more closed Japanese society.
So you get that 1977 recording live in Japan, and you hear this song, Neon Angels on the Road to Ruin. And it's a pretty sobering title in light of what happens next, but we'll get to that part of the story in a moment. Here's The Runaways. That's The Runaways live in Japan in 1977. The kind of manic reaction of the fans there in Japan seems to have taken even The Runaways by surprise. That song is called Neon Angels on the Road to Ruin. Evelyn McDonald's with me on Soundcheck, author of Queens of Noise, The Real Story of The Runaways. With the benefit of hindsight, Evelyn, do you look at a title like Neon Angels on the Road to Ruin and wonder who knew what when?
Yeah, no, it is. It's sadly ironic. And, this was one of the sort of bullying tactics that Kim Fowley had, was he would tell them that the band was only going to last 5 years because they couldn't call themselves the Runaways when they were in their 20s. So he always sort of held out this ticking time bomb over them that they weren't built to last. They were built for speed, but not for endurance.
Right.
And I think that they were really ground up. They toured and played and recorded and in such so much in such a short period of time that I think that they were very burnt out and ruined by the end of those 4 years.
Well, and you know, you think, well, they're touring constantly, they're making records, and maybe they're not big in the States, but they're big in Europe, and they're enormous in Japan. They must be making money. But then you write, you know, they're doing concerts because Lita needs to pay for her amp and stuff like that. You know, I mean, the money's hard to come by. There's the old song about bad contracts, you know, underage musicians who don't know what they're doing, signing away rights and stuff. We don't even have time to get into the parade of revolving bass players in the band, but it wasn't even 5 years. It was just 4 years. What was the death knell for the band?
Well, I think the death knell was when the record company just stopped supporting them. And they were out there on the road, on their own, literally abandoned, living from show to show, and still making really great music, but getting no promotional support, and then ultimately getting dropped.
And, you know, there was a lot of drug use and a lot of sniping between the members of the band. But some of those members, I mean, Joan Jett, of course, becomes one of the big solo artists of the 1980s. And what about the sort of lingering echoes, influence of the Runaways? Do you hear that in the Riot Girl movement of the 90s, for example?
Well, absolutely. The Riot Girl movement really reclaimed the Runaways from history and actively, you know, Cherry Bomb was covered by the band Bratmobile. Joan Jett produced one of Bikini Kill's greatest singles. I think in general, the Runaways were one of the first punk bands, and mm-hmm. I also think they were one of the first hair metal bands, and I think the entire Los Angeles music scene of the rock scene of the next decade was heavily influenced by that band, whether it's, you know, the Sunset Strip scene or the mask punk scene, and you can trace, you know, Lita Ford was hanging out with Nikki Sixx, and Joan Jett was producing the Germs. So music in general, I think, was affected by the Runaways. Today, you still see their influence. And Cherie Currie has a huge following still and is still out there playing music. Cherie, Joan, and Lita are all out on the road and actively recording.
And all of them involved in this book by Evelyn McDonald called Queens of Noise, The Real Story of the Runaways. And Evelyn, it is quite an amazing story, well told. Thanks for sharing it with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you for having me, John.
Always interested to hear your feedback about this or any other episode of Soundcheck. You can leave us a message at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Or send us an email, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff with Amy Pearl. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. See you next time. This is Soundcheck.